Did any of you see, and if you did see it, do you remember the movie American President? Anybody remember that? Michael Douglas starred in it. Anybody? How many? Raise your hands high. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay. You didn't have to see the movie to get this. Michael Douglas, not endorsing the movie. But there's a scene in the movie which I'm sure the screenwriters in Hollywood intended to show a very forceful and dynamic Michael Douglas playing an American president in decisiveness and leadership ability. So again, you don't have to have seen the movie or to remember it, but there's an exchange that takes place during a crisis between Michael Douglas, who's playing the president. You'll have to admit that back in 1995, looked good in a $3,000 suit as the president, looked vibrant and healthy and kind of looked like what Hollywood would cast as a president, which they did, I guess. But the exchange takes place between Michael Fox, who plays one of the aides to the president, and then Michael Douglas. And it happens because of a crisis within the White House, because the president, Michael Douglas, not the real president, the president is being attacked by one of his opponents who's running for election, and this president is running for re-election. He's being attacked for the fact that he has a girlfriend. Okay, let's just leave it at that. So because of that attack, and the president has tried to remain above the fray of the criticism and hasn't responded, his aide says in the crowded Oval Office, says, they don't have a choice. Bob Rumsum, he's the individual that is the opponent, is the only one doing the talking, and he's criticizing the president. People want leadership, Mr. President. And in the absence of genuine leadership, they'll listen to anyone who steps up to the microphone. They want leadership. They're so thirsty for it, they'll crawl through the desert toward a mirage. And when they discover there's no water, they'll drink the sand. Really? I'm glad you laughed, because when you read it like that, it just sounds kind of funny. The president responds, and I'm sure that they intended this to be dramatic and decisive. And in the movie, it kind of was, as I remember it. Lewis, we've had presidents who were beloved, who couldn't find a coherent sentence with two hands and a flashlight. People don't drink the sand because they're thirsty. They drink the sand because they don't know the difference. Now, in the movie, it was so dramatic, and it stole the day, and everybody stepped back and, oh, wow, that's really wise. But when you think about it, when you really analyze it, it's a real critique against the public. And I'm sure that whether it was intended or not, I'm sure that the Hollywood elite, the screenwriters that wrote that, intended it to be a knock against the people who would drink the sand. So, in a way, although it came across in the movie very dramatic, they're really denigrating their own audience, the ones that wrote the script, because they can't tell sand from water. They're so stupid. In addition, he casts aspersions towards past presidents. Can't find a coherent sentence with two hands and a flashlight. I'm pretty sure, since this was written in 1995, I'm pretty sure that they had Ronald Reagan in mind when they wrote that, but they couldn't have been further from the truth, by the way. But anyway, it may have looked good on the screen, but it does make a point about how those that rule evaluate their kingdoms, quote unquote. We are less than 90 days, less than 3 months from a choice of a new president in our land. And we're kind of in the gun lap in the choice and the selection of a new leader in this nation, a new president. And we don't know what the outcome is going to be, because there are any number of scenarios that could unfold between now and November 8th. And according to the polls, it is very tight right now, very neck and neck, and we really don't know how it's going to turn out, although from just the looks of it and from past elections, it's really not the popular vote, as you understand, that counts. It's the electoral vote, and from that point of view, almost any Democrat nominee has a distinct advantage according to past elections and according to key states and according to the where population is in each and every state. And you need 270 or 271 to win. 270, I think. And a Democrat, based on past electoral results, begins with an advantage of 240 votes. You don't have to win too many others to get those 30. But we don't know what the outcome is going to be. And make no doubt about it, I've been around a lot of elections and I've been around a lot of analysis done in and out of the church. My own personal view is that, and so I'll just give you my own personal prejudice, that sometimes we have said, well, it doesn't really matter what's going to happen. God will have his way. And in some ways that is true, and that obviously is true. God's plan is going to come to fruition, make no doubt about it. But I guess I would posit that God allows the people to make the decision, and wherever the people choose is where it's going to happen. The people are going to make one choice, because we can't have it both ways. We can't say that God has had his hands off on society and mankind in general and still say that he influences elections. He knows the end from the beginning, so he knows what's going to happen, but we don't. So that is really not pertinent necessarily to the message today. But one way or another, the selection that the American people make will have an effect. It will change the way people live, even as the last 8 years have changed things greatly in our society, even as norms have deviated from even the fairly low standards that they were 8 years ago. There have been dramatic changes in our society, and there have been things that have impacted all of people's lives. So policy changes and directions that presidents or leaders of nations take their country do have an impact. And one way or another, for better or for worse, things will change in November 8th. Maybe you could say it'll be worse no matter what. Okay, that's one opinion. But one thing that has happened in the last 8 years truly is that other nations have been testing the waters to see just how far they can go before they will be stopped by the world's greatest superpower. And we all know who those bad actors are on the world stage. Each of them in their own way are seeing just how far they can go. And there are some evil, evil people out there in the world today. And many of them, many of the leaders of the world are evil, are absolutely evil according to God's standards. And many of them are striving for power and to see who is going to dominate on the world scene. This election is very important because the United States is still viewed as the world's only superpower. And depending on the direction that that superpower goes, will tell a lot about how other nations will tend to act. Whether people select one candidate or another, it is very obvious that our nation is divided, 50% here, 50% there, maybe 49-52, 49-51, 48-52, one way or another. But our nation is divided, but it is crying out for leadership. And maybe there are some people that can't tell the sand from water. I don't know. But they're still crying out for leadership. As the world's lone superpower, America could, as Teddy Roosevelt said many years ago, over 100 years ago, that America could still speak softly and carry a big stick and could wield a lot of influence. In the prophecy of Micah, It speaks about the end time in chapter 5. It speaks about long off into the future from the time when this prophet wrote in the late 700s BC. He looked, or God allowed him to look into the future to see the descendants of Jacob, the descendants of Israel, and how they would react in the modern times that we have lived in. And in verse 7, it says, then the remnant of Jacob, that would be those at the end of the line, so to speak, not just a small group, but those far away into the future, the descendants of Jacob, shall be in the midst of many peoples, like dew from the Lord, like showers on the grass. Those are the blessings of God. And in the last 200 years of the dominance of the remnant of Jacob, the world has been blessed. Now, the United States hasn't always acted appropriately, hasn't always made the best decisions. Our leaders haven't always done the right thing, but truly, the world is much better off because of that American hegemony and that leadership and power and dominance over the world scene. It's frightening to think of what the world might be like had it been dominated by Gentile nations, because we know from history how they can rule, or how they, if they had not been put down appropriately at the right times. And the remnant of Jacob shall be among the Gentiles in the midst of many peoples, like a lion among the beasts of the forest, like a young lion among flocks of sheep, who if he passes through both treads down and tears in pieces, and none can deliver. Your hand shall be lifted against your adversaries, and all your enemies shall be cut off. Now, I won't go into it, the prophecies of Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, but those prophecies also foretell a time late into the future from the time that they were given, a time in which the peoples of Israel would flee from their enemies, and they would not have that kind of influence. Right now, that power is still there. We haven't always used it appropriately. We haven't always used it righteously, but it's still been there. The question is, and I think we're all interested in this question and the answer to it, will the remnant of Jacob still be, or will it once again be this powerful force among the nations? Well, we'll find out in less than 3 months, won't we? We'll find out which direction this country has chosen to go. But clearly, in the past 8 years, we have seen how a change in policy can bring about a change in the world and how it views the United States, the sons, the remnant of Jacob, the sons of Israel. So will the United States recover not only its leadership, but also respect and fear? Or will it continue its current path of encouraging the jackals of the nations? Well, we'll find out. As we know, Bible prophecy does point to a time of very powerful and dangerous leadership in the future, assuming the mantle of global leadership with the demise and the influence of Jacob. We've read even recently in recent messages, I think all of us in the ministry have read from Revelation 13, of this terrifying time that is coming upon the world at some point. We don't know when, and we don't know exactly how it is going to come about. We have history as a guide, but the aspect of time we don't know. But there is coming a time in which there will be powerful leadership. You could compare sometimes the unrighteousness of leaders today in any nation, I suppose. But there is coming a time in which there will be unrighteous leadership, which will have power that far exceeds any power the world has ever seen before. And that power is characterized as beastly, as beasts, or as powerful, like the beast of Micah 5, a powerful lion. But these are different beasts. Jacob is compared to a powerful lion, among the king of all the beasts of the jungle, right? But this is even more terrifying than that. Now, the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. The dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. So there's a concordant between the devil and this earthly power, this beastly power. And as Daniel explains, beasts are kingdoms. So this is a kingdom that is going to arise. And I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. That's about a space of 1,000 years between the wound and the wound being healed, covered in just less than a verse. And all the world marveled and followed the beast. So they worshiped the dragon who gave authority to the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him?" In the future, and again, we don't know how far off, the world is going to follow leadership. And the world is going to be deceived, and truly the world is going to be looking at a mirage. And not to make too much out of Michael J. Fox's statement, they will drink the sand. The world will have leadership, and the leadership of the end time is going to be unrighteous. In Revelation 13 and verse 7, it says, "It was granted to him to make war with the saints." That's us. That's with our church, our people, our offspring, people that are fellow servants of God. Now, some of you have been to war, or you've been close to war. This is going to be war against the church, war against the people of God, and to overcome them. "And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation, and all who dwell on the earth will worship him, whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world." So we see that Satan empowers the beast, and look at the damage that is done by that power. But in the book of Romans, in chapter 8, in the book of Romans, we see hope for all of us, all of the people of God. There is this coming time of calamity, but in spite of all of that, you need, and I need, we all need to see ourselves as a part of a final solution that will be presented for the world. In Romans chapter 8 and verse 5, it says, "For those who live according to the flesh set their minds on the things of the flesh." And that will happen in spades during the time of the great tribulation. "But those who live according to the Spirit, the things of the Spirit." Paul said in Colossians 3, to set your mind on things above. Verse 6, "For to be carnally minded," that is to be motivated by the flesh, "is death. But to be spiritually minded is life and peace. Because the carnal," or the, not the carnal is necessarily of and by itself, something nasty or horrible, it can be, but because the human mind is enmity against God. It is not subject to the law of God, nor indeed can be. So then, those who are in the flesh cannot please God. But you're not in the flesh, but in the Spirit, if indeed the Spirit of God dwells in you. Now, if anyone does not have the Spirit of Christ, he is not his. Brethren, God is developing within you, within the saints of God, within us, a new kind of leadership. Both men and women, and these leaders have a different mindset, a different attitude, and a different heart than the leaders of this world. No matter how hard they may try, no matter who may become president and how much they want to help and to serve, and either if they were of that mind that they really want to serve people, or if they were of mind that they were just simply there to fulfill their own ambitions and their own desires, God is replacing that with you. Because you have a different mind and a different heart than the leaders of this world, because you are ambassador of a different kingdom. Verse 14 of Romans 8 says, "For as many as are led by the Spirit of God, these are the sons of God." And in verse 16, The Spirit itself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, then heirs. Heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer with him, that we also may be glorified together. A passage of which certainly applies to those that we have recently lost. That time awaits them. So, God has brought all of us into his plan, and he's developing the leadership that we have affectionately called the leaders of the world tomorrow, right here within our midst. I am honored to be able to speak to those that God has called to be leaders of the world tomorrow. In verse 19, it says, "The earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God." It's a metaphorical phrase. It's a word picture, a word image. Not that this physical creation has emotions, but it's as if it did. It's groaning and travailing and waiting, for the creation was subjected to futility. It had a limited span, in other words, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope. What is the hope? The hope is in the future, eternity later on, because the creation itself will also be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. These physical things, earth, not important. Physical creation, just a type. This is the kind of leadership that the world needs but does not have. Well, it has it, as Mr. Armstrong said, in embryonic form within the church of God, within the people of God, and that is the kind of leadership that the world is looking for now. These sons of God that are mentioned in the book of Romans will meet and exceed the expectations of mankind after Christ's return. Let's turn to Revelation 3 and verse 21. Revelation 3 and verse 21, "To him who overcomes, I will grant to sit with me on my throne, as I also overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne." So we're talking about, thousands of people through history. Sounds like a crowded throne, right? Sit there together. It's metaphorical. It's a word picture. It's talking about rulership. The sons of God, the people of God, the church of God will meet and exceed the expectations of mankind. And there will be a mankind after Christ returns. Christ overcame and sat next to God the Father. Those who otherwise overcome, the saints of God, will also rule with him. And previously in Revelation 2, in verse 26, he mentions exactly that same group of people. "You and he who overcomes and keeps my works until the end, to him I will give power over the nations." Over the nations. "He shall rule them with a rod of iron." That is Jesus Christ. But he will need help, and God has allowed us to share. "They shall be dashed to pieces like potter's vessels, as I also receive from my Father. So those who overcome, those who persevere until the end, you will provide that leadership for the world." Now, there are many prophecies that attest to this, that talk about this, that talk about a change in leadership that is coming upon the world, not the one coming in 3 months. That's going to be important. It's been the most interesting of times and the most interesting of election cycles that I can ever remember. But regardless of the outcome, the future awaits. The future awaits. Certainly it will be important. The direction is a choice probably unlike any that has ever been seen in our nation. But Psalm chapter 2 points to the time ahead, actually at the time of Christ's return. The time when Christ returns, it's not going to be a time in which, oh, Christ is here, everything is great. His feet come, land on the mountain Olives, the Mount of Olives is split in two. Well, I guess they were right. That church of God, the two witnesses, I guess here he is. We were wrong, let us bow, let us submit. No, it's not going to happen. There will still be a lot of deception in the world. And the nations, actually they're called the heathen, they're going to rage. They're going to war, they're going to fight. Many prophecies show that. Many prophecies even within the book of Revelation. Why do the nations, why do the heathen, your Bible may say, why do they rage? Why do the people plot a vain thing? What's their plot? Kill him. That's what they want to do. The kings of the earth set themselves, and this is happening at the time of Christ's return, they're going to set themselves together. And the rulers are going to take counsel together. They're going to get together. Two witnesses have broadcast this. They say this is going to happen. The two witnesses are put to death shortly after Christ returns. And I'm not going through a whole timetable. You can drive yourself batty. Okay, what's exactly the timeline? Let's get it right. We must understand this. You don't have to understand a timeline. You don't. And you're probably going to get it wrong if you try to put all the pieces in the puzzle. It's like a Rubik's Cube. Anybody, were any of you ever good at that? That was the rage for a while, remember? Some little 7-year-old goes, tick, 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 2 seconds. Everything's in place. You don't have to put it all together to be a Christian. It's kind of nice to have a general understanding of prophecy, but the kings of the earth set themselves together, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed. That's not a surprise, because they've done that before. It shows in Revelation 12, Revelation 13, Daniel 7. They attack, they make war on the saints, etc., etc. They're saying, let us break their bonds in pieces. What are the bonds? God's laws, God's way, God's rulership, God's ownership over them, and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens shall laugh. Jesus Christ. The Lord shall hold them in derision. Then he shall speak to them in his wrath and distress them in his deep displeasure. Yet I have set my king on my holy hill of Zion. I will declare the decree. The Lord has said to me, you are my son. Today I've begotten you. Ask of me and I will give you the nations for your inheritance, and the ends of the earth for your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall dash them to pieces like a potter's vessel. Only those who oppose God. Of course, the Son of God will have power over the nations. But notice how he brings all of those who are sitting here today and elsewhere among the churches of God into the same responsibilities. Hebrews chapter 2. Hebrews 2 verses 5 through 11. For he has not put the world to come of which we speak, and all those things that we've mentioned now, the world to come immediately, and there's other in that sense times to come, but he has not put the world to come of which we speak in subjection to angels. Not their role, not what they do. But one testified in a certain place, saying, what is man that you are mindful of him, or the son of man that you take care of him? You have made him a little lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor, and you have set him over the works of your hands. And indeed, mankind is over the work of God's hands, this world. He's there, divided into groups of people all around the globe. You've put all things in subjection under his feet. For in that he put all in subjection under him, he left nothing that is not put under him, but now we do not yet see all things put under him. But we see Jesus, who is made a little lower than the angels, just like man, for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he, that is Jesus, by the grace of God, might taste death for everyone. For it was fitting for him, for whom are all things and by whom are all things, in bringing many sons to glory. That glory is eternity, is eternal life. To make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings, for both he who sanctifies and those who are being sanctified are all of one, for which reason he is not ashamed to call them brethren. Now, in various times in the Church of God, there's been this, would you call it controversy or question? I don't know. What will we be at the resurrection? And all you have to do is go to the Scripture and see that we will be brethren of Jesus Christ. We will be sons and daughters. Everything points to a family relationship and an incorruptible spirit life. So that's where we're going, that's where we're headed, but initially for 1,000 years to rule the nations. So the Son of God is going to share with the sons of God the leadership of the world to come. Or, it's not in the Bible, the world tomorrow. This world tomorrow. Well, maybe the day after tomorrow, but you know, you get my point. But today, we are so ordinary, and we are so weak and subject to the problems of the flesh, right? That's why we live. We have our 70 years, maybe sometimes a little more, maybe sometimes a little less, and we die. We're subject to disease and illness and problems and the difficulties of life. People used to say in the church when I first came into the church, people didn't die of all these horrible diseases 100 years ago, I was 20 years old at the time, 19, 20, 18 maybe when I first started attending church. Even then, that didn't really make sense to me because I knew that even though people did live long lives, the average lifespan was a lot less. So, no, we didn't have all these degenerative diseases and cancers and blah, blah, blah. It's because people didn't live long enough to get them. Truly. I mean, people died of very ordinary things 100 years ago or 110 years ago. People died of the common cold. People died of so many things that are almost unheard of. Maybe sometimes some of these illnesses make a comeback, but the average lifespan of the American male was 50. Actually, it was less than that. It was 49 in the year 1900. Now, that doesn't mean that there weren't people that lived into their 80s and 90s and 100s. No. And somebody's going to bring up or think, well, my uncle died at 106, you know, and or my great-great-grandfather. Okay, there are exceptions to all of that, and that person came from a very stout gene pool, undoubtedly. But on the average, the point of all of this is, that we are human. And our human lifespan is not necessarily all that important. The important thing is that we're learning to be faithful to the leadership of Jesus Christ in the flesh. So the caution is, at least it's given as a warning, that some who begin that training program under Christ's leadership may not fulfill it. And that's brought out, and we hope it doesn't happen. We hope everybody that is truly been called of God, hopefully they all make the right choice, right, and are there serving with Jesus Christ at his return through the resurrection. But Luke 19 is a parable given as a warning, not as a prophecy, but as a warning to all of us, and we should rehearse that, all of us as future kings and priests. Luke 19, beginning in verse 12. A certain nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and to return. So he called 10 of his servants, delivered to them 10 minas, whatever that is, and said to them, well, it's a coin, and said to them, do business till I come. But his citizens hated him, sent a delegation after him, saying, we will not have this man to reign over us. And so it was that when he had returned, having received the kingdom, he then commanded these servants to whom he had given the money to be called to him, that he might know how much every man had gained by trading. And then came the first, saying, Master, your mina has earned 10 minas. And he said to him, well done, good servant, because you are faithful in a very little, have authority over 10 cities. And the second came, saying, Master, your mina has earned 5 minas. And he said, you also be over 5 cities. And not everybody got the same amount, right? That's God's decision. Then another came, saying, Master, here's your mina, which I have kept put away in a handkerchief, for I feared you because you were an austere man. You collect what you did not deposit. You reap what you did not sow. And he said to him, out of your own mouth I will judge you, you wicked servant. This individual had come to the wrong conclusion about who and what God was. And he's not that austere man. He made an excuse for the fact that he did nothing with the gift. And he's chastised. Why didn't you just put it in the bank that it might collect interest? And he said to those who stood by, take the mina from him, give it to him who has 10 minas. But they said to him, Master, wait a minute, he's already got 10. Okay, well, he's going to get another one because he knows what to do with it. For I say to you that everyone who has will be given, and from him who does not have, even what he has will be taken away from him. But bring here those enemies of mine who did not want me to reign over them and slay them before me. It is a warning. It's a prophecy that can fail, but it's a warning to all who have been called of God. This individual did nothing. He disobeyed. He falls into the category of the individuals at the beginning of the book of Revelation 21 who were disobedient, fearful, disobedient, and pursuing the pleasures of the flesh. In Matthew chapter 24, another parable, very similar to this, regarding what God gives us at this time and how we qualify as leaders in the future. Matthew 24 and verse 45 through 51. Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his master has made ruler over his household to give them food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. No digging talents, putting them in the ground, saving things away, but continuing to strive despite the circumstances, no matter what they are. Assuredly, I say to you that he will make him ruler over all his goods. But if that evil servant says in his heart, my master is delaying his coming, and begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with the drunkards, the master of that servant will come in a day when he's not looking. Always kind of reminds me in a humorous way of the Far Side cartoon where there's two guys in a boat and they're out on a lake and one of them looks over in the horizon. There's a huge mushroom cloud. You know, it's nuclear annihilation time. And one of them says, hey, you know what that means? And the guy says, yep, there's no limit today on what we can catch. No fishermen here? Okay. No. Well, so much for trying humor. I guess I better leave that to the pros. The point is this, that we are expected, no matter what the circumstances that we live in or called in, we are expected to perform and do the things that God has given to us to do. So the duties are compared to a servant who takes care of a household. We are all servants in a household. Galatians chapter 6 and verse 10. We are servants in the household of faith. The household of faith. Galatians chapter 6 and verse 10, therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially those who are of the household of faith. That is the church of God. We have a responsibility then, each one of us, for the care, the preservation of the household of faith. That's what you have a responsibility to do. So how can you do that? How can you, as a future leader, take care of that household and contribute to that household and be a good servant of that household? Well, one of the things is understanding who and what you are. You know, it may sound self-serving in a sense, but have you ever thought about that, who and what you are as an individual? In 1 Corinthians chapter 12, we find that there is absolutely no doubt about it, but there are gifts and abilities that are given within the church of God. Now, we've read 1 Corinthians 12 many times before. It talks about the differences in the body. But God distributes gifts, abilities to every single one. The obvious message that Paul was giving to the people in Corinth was that you are talented, you have gifts, different abilities that, you know, from the time you are born, you have natural gifts, proclivities, and abilities, and it is the responsibility of you to understand where your gifts lie, and you can find that out through prayer, through fasting, through meditation, through asking God, where are my gifts? It was a big thing in Ambassador College years ago. I remember we were working on the paint crew, and we were freshmen. Or maybe it was, I wasn't on the paint crew yet. This story was relayed to me by a couple of my classmates who were kind of jokers. But they had a very serious individual who was on their work crew. And we had just covered this passage in one of our Bible classes, probably freshman Bible. And this poor fellow was lamenting while they were working. And we all had to work. When I went to Ambassador College, we all had to work 20 hours a week, plus go to school, everything else. And that's what we did. But as they're painting away one of the dorms, this fellow laments, well, you know, you so-and-so, you have such great speaking ability, and you have this gifts, and you, motions to his other coworker, you're really good at this, and you really know how to do this and that and yada, yada. I don't have any gifts at all. And as they're working, they felt sorry for him, and one of them said, that's not true. And at first it began to be very serious. That's not true. Dave, you've got lots of gifts. Oh, I do? Oh, what do you guys see in me? And then it turned a little ridiculous. Well, Dave, here's what you are. Let me think. You got a lot of gifts. Bob, you chime in. Tell him where. Yeah. He's got. And you know, of course, as it goes on, you can guess what happened. They couldn't name any gifts that he had, and so I guess they all laughed about it later on. But every one of us has gifts. You all have gifts in which to serve and benefit the entire household. Now, you notice I didn't really read anything from 1 Corinthians 12. I just want you to look at that yourself, because it shows that in Corinth, they had a lot of people that had gifts, and those gifts were being misused, and they're not being misused in any way in our congregations today that I know of, but I just think it's good for each one to know that there are ways that you can contribute within the household of faith. I will turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 6. 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 1. Dare any of you, having a matter against another, go to law before the unrighteous and not before the saints? Do you not know that the saints will judge the world? That's the point. The saints are going to judge the world, and if the world will be judged by you, are you unworthy to judge the smallest matters? This was a topic that Dr. Ward covered in one of his recent letters. I did not send it out to you because I got busy at the end of the week and it just came out, but some of you that look on the members' website may have read this. This was a time in our past in which sometimes people would try to employ the ministry to solve issues between themselves, and that's not really necessary. And I think that a lot of times, that's in, the past. And I think oftentimes people are able to solve matters among brethren. We will have those matters that come up, and we need to have the gift and the ability of discernment and forgiveness to be able to take care of those things. But the point I'm wanting to make that if in this life we have been called to make correct judgments and we see that it is a lifelong process, that's a part of our training as well. Turn to Ephesians chapter 4, and I'll begin in verse 4. Again, this passage speaks about how gifts have been given to men, and you can have spiritual gifts within the body of Christ. There is one body and one spirit, just as you were called in one hope of your calling, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is above all and through all and in you all. But to each one of us, grace was given according to the measure of Christ's gift. Therefore, he says, when he ascended on high, he led captivity captive and gave gifts to men. So God has given gifts to the body of Christ. And he mentions, I think this was incorrectly rendered in some ways in our evaluations in the past, in Ephesians 4, looking at a hierarchical government form, when it really is describing an aspect of service within the church of God. Verse 11 of Ephesians 4, he gave himself some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors, and teachers. Now, those are titles that maybe we haven't really ever understood all that well. But at one time we had one who we thought was sent, called an apostle. That began in about the early 1950s when one of the ministers identified Herbert Armstrong by that title. He didn't really identify himself by that title. Somebody else did, and I think that's, and maybe that's where he fit within the calling of God. One sent, and he certainly did go to many leaders and proclaim, and many peoples and proclaim the true gospel. But prophets, we haven't had any prophets in the church. Maybe evangelists, pastors, teachers, we have ministers. The point of all of this is that those offices of service are for the equipping of the saints, for the work of ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ. And that applies to all of us. There's really nothing more exciting for me than to listen to a good message from one of my comrades in the ministry. And the purpose is so that there's edification, so that we can be warned, so that as the people of God, verse 14 says that we're no longer children, we're no longer tossed to and fro and carried about with every wind of doctrine. It's a gift. It's a matter of a gift to the church. 1 Timothy chapter 1. This is a continuation from the first century through the many eras of the Church of God up until this time. Paul told Timothy to identify those that God was calling to the task. He mentions in verse 3, 1 Timothy 1, 3, as I urged you when I went into Macedonia, remain in Ephesus, that you may charge some that they teach no other doctrine, nor give heed to fables and endless genealogies which cause disputes rather than godly edification, which is in faith. Now the purpose of the commandment is love from a pure heart, from a good conscience, and from sincere faith, from which some, having strayed, having turned aside to idle talk, desiring to be teachers of the law, understanding neither what they say nor the things which they affirm, but we know that the law is good if one uses it lawfully. There was a danger at that time in leadership, even within the Church of God. Teachers, leaders, ministers, we've seen it all before, they can go astray, and so can members. There's a higher expectation, there's a higher condemnation towards those who God places in an office of service like the ministry. But James brings that out. Brethren, let not many of you become teachers. James 3:1, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment. For we all stumble in many things. If anyone does not stumble in the word, he is a perfect man and able also to bridle the whole body. So, this applies to all of us in training for the kingdom of God. All of us who will be kings and priests. Turn to 1 Peter chapter 5. 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 1 through 4. The elders who are among you I exhort, I who am a fellow elder and a witness to the sufferings of Christ, and also a partaker of the glory that will be revealed. Shepherd the flock which is among you, serving as overseers, not by compulsion, but willingly, not for dishonest gain, but eagerly, not as being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the crown of glory that does not fade away. Well, it is instruction to the ministry, a human ministry, but it's also instruction for everybody here listening to these words, because you will be in that place of much greater power and authority, and we're all now in position for that training that will place us in those positions to lead and to serve, to lead and to serve. And that's something that from the time of the Garden of Eden, mankind hasn't often gotten very right. Very rarely have we seen in this world through 6,000 years leadership which is devoted to the service of others. More often than not, even in this world, we see the striving for power, and we see the craziness that comes from man's desire to lead others, not serve them, but to grab power for themselves. Had an interesting chat with a physician, actually yesterday, from Syria. He's a Christian Syrian. He has been in this country for about 20 years between medical school and private practice, and he's got a brother that's still in Damascus. There is a Christian community that still lives in Damascus. It's been years since he's been able, 2010, since he's been able to go back there because of the unrest. And I said, oh, so you haven't been back because of the civil war? He said, there's no civil war in Syria. It was interesting to get his perspective. There's unrest because Turkey is in conflict with Syria. And, you know, kind of, we talked about a lot of things, but it kind of brought into clear focus what I had thought that had happened back during Benghazi, which he confirmed, because he's got a lot of friends in Syria still able to communicate despite the war that's taking place. Actually went to school with the brother of President Assad in a Catholic school. He said, we all live very sheltered lives. And he said he later went on to medical school. He came back. He wasn't the ruthless dictator that his father was. The President Assad that died a number of years ago was the dictator, and he ruled with an iron fist. And if there was opposition, guess what? I said, okay, they go into prison. He says, no, there weren't that many people in prison. They disappear. Under absolute rulerships and dictatorships, they don't fill up the prisons, they just fill up the graves. It's interesting. So he said his son is not like that. His son married an American wife, came back, they tried to do some noble things, set up orphanages, but the people under in that society that had worked for his father, many of them were evil people. And evil men try to gain power and try to do this and that, and it is a mess. I mean, you can see very clearly that whatever policy we pursue as a nation in the United States, and we rarely ever hear what is actually going on. And the U.S. was funneling guns from Libya. That's why we had the attack on the embassy there, or not embassy, CIA compound, go to Turkey. Those guns being supplied through Turkey to the rebels, which we're supposed to be against. But anyway, it just shows how strange things can be. A lot more. I won't go into it. It'll drag the sermon. There are qualifications of leadership that do not change from the Bible. We'll cover those as we close today. These are good reminders of how we need to be as people, because whether you're talking about the Old Testament or the New Testament, the Old Covenant, New Covenant, these are consistent throughout the Bible and good reminders for us. Exodus 18 and verse 21. Moses was, now I'm going to cover these quickly, just jot down the scriptures. You're not going to be able to turn to them. I want to end on time. Are you ready? Exodus 18, 21. Moreover, you shall select from all the people able men such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place over them to be rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, rulers of ten. Even though that came from Moses' father-in-law, and even though it was a system that came from his ancient times, he was right on several things. Able men, those that fear God, men of truth that hate covetousness. Deuteronomy 1, verses 13 and 14. Choose wise, understanding, knowledgeable men from among your tribes, and I will make them heads over you. This is where we want to be. Wise, understanding. God's commandments give us understanding. Acts chapter 6 and verse 3. Therefore, brethren, seek out from among you seven men of good reputation, full of the Holy Spirit and wisdom, whom we may appoint over this business. And then, of course, the very famous passage in Deuteronomy 17, when God foresaw the eventual selection of the people to have a king and want to have a king, this is what they were told to do. You remember that. When you come into the land which the Lord your God is giving you and possess it and dwell in it and say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses, one from among your brethren you shall set as a king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. That is actually a part of the code of the United States, isn't it? You have to be a natural born citizen of the United States to become president. Most of the time. Anyway, sorry. Don't set a foreigner over you who is not your brother, but he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself. Verse 17. And it shall be that when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write for himself a copy of this law in a book. Now, I know that I've known people in a church who have endeavored to do this, to actually write out the Bible themselves. The law was not as long then, and it's a nice idea, but it's not necessary to study the Bible that way. But you should study the Bible to understand what it says, and more importantly, you should apply it to you. Because the book of Hebrews says that it's like a two-edged sword dividing asunder, and it helps us to understand the thoughts and the intents of our own heart, right? That is one of the primary tasks of a Christian, is to understand the book of the law, but more importantly, to apply that understanding in righteous living. In Proverbs chapter 29 and verse 2, we see the results of righteous leadership. Now, as I close today, I will say that even in this world, you can see the differences between good leadership, good policies, righteousness as far as man can go, and bad leadership and bad policies on the right-hand side, my right-hand side, your left, okay. On the right-hand side, there is a difference made when people obey God's law more. When people obey God's law less and they're dishonest, people view that. Whether they're looking for water, sand, whatever, okay, the analogy breaks down, whatever, people will follow. And when I say follow, their actions will be manifest. If that leader is good, society generally will be better off than if they have a bad leader and that person is wicked and covetous and that person is totally unrighteous and doesn't respect the law of God. Even in our society today, this choice is better than that choice. Proverbs 29 and verse 2 says that when the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. But when the wicked bear rule, the people mourn. The King James Version. Well, brethren, the scriptures clearly show that Satan has and will continue to use his techniques in this world to divide and conquer, and will also attempt to divide and conquer the people of God. He can and does use his tools of discouragement, bitterness, dissension to even affect the people of God. But looking forward, the world needs leadership. The world needs you. And Christ has promised that you will help him lead in the world tomorrow after qualifying for those leadership positions. You, we, can all be those righteous leaders.